we read for you. Atlantis, the Dark Continent. A book by Paul Williamson and Linda Braithwaite. Read by JP on Wolf Spirit Radio. Atlantis, the Dark Continent. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio. Chapter 7, Linda's Story. I was brought up in a small market town in the Lake District. As an only child, I was lonely and made few friends. I spent many long hours on my own, exploring the beautiful countryside all around me. I loved to be in the woods, watching the changing seasons and the cycle of life as it unfolded. The trees were my friends, and I knew them all. They had an energy I could feel, and I used to curl up at the bottom of their huge trunks and sense the life force all around me. I found this a great comfort in my loneliness. Being an unhappy child, as I grew older, I withdrew into myself and my own world more and more. I hated school and frequently played truant, going to watch the trains on the local railway. In summer, I would sit for hours in the flower-filled grass of the embankments. I loved the railway, and I used to go behind the station to a fence, observing the activity around the steam engines as they took on water and used the turntable. It particularly pleased me if I got a friendly wave from the engine crews. Although I thought nothing of it at the time, on some of my solo wanderings in the woods and along the lakeside, I was met and accompanied by an American Indian. He just seemed to appear, and I accepted his presence without being afraid of him. His name was Red Eagle. He became my secret friend and was gentle and kind. He told me wonderful stories about the animals and taught me about the plants and trees, the earth and the stars. Everything seemed so magical with him. I never told anyone about him, not even my parents. I sensed they would not understand anyway. One year, our school organized a painting competition, so I did a portrait of my friend and won first prize. Everyone commented on the unusual subject and how lifelike he was. As I grew older, he appeared to me less and less, and eventually went away. When I came to leave school, I had nothing in the way of exam qualifications, so at 15 had to seek work. There were few prospects in our hometown, so it was decided by my family to move away. I found it heartbreaking parting from the mountains and woods I loved so much. Eventually, we came to Morecambe and settled. We had only been there a short time when my father left. One day he just went out and never came back. By then I was working in the local chemist and Mum had started to take in sewing so we could make ends meet. We were living in a small, dreary flat and life was difficult. At school I had learned to sing and colleagues at work persuaded me to join a local operatic society. Quickly I made lots of new friends and at last began enjoying life. When I was 19... I met Michael, and we started going out together. 2 years later, we married, I started nursing, and life was looking up. Soon after that, though, Michael became seriously ill and lost his robust health. He became unable to work. We moved away to Devon to make a new start, but things did not work out for us. After a few traumatic and unhappy years, we returned to Morecambe. Although my parents were Church of England, they never practiced as such, rarely going to church. They didn't push me one way or the other, even though I did attend Sunday school for a while. I found institutionalized religion boring and irrelevant. Slowly I began to realize deep inside I needed to understand and try to explain all of the traumatic events that seemed to beset me. I was deeply unhappy with my life. There had to be more to things than what I perceived. My experiences at work over the years with seriously ill and dying patients set my mind thinking. Gradually, this helped to awaken my interest in spiritual matters. I began to look for answers, scouring libraries and bookshops. In the 70s, there wasn't much literature on such available on In the 70s, there wasn't much literature on such subjects available. Then, a book was published which changed all that. Raymond Moody's best-selling Life After Life. Devouring this book, I realized that it made sense. Somewhere, it struck a familiar chord and I was fired with enthusiasm to know more. Most of the books I could find were American. They seemed way ahead of Britain on this subject. I read everything I could lay my hands on. Eventually, the subjects of reincarnation, past lives, and spirit guides came to my attention. I discovered that most of the writers mentioned the existence of personal guides or guardian angels, spiritual beings who were with us throughout our life, loving and protecting us, assisting us through life's ups and downs. Intuitively, I had always felt that everyone had someone like this with them, and this was not alone. However, I had no conscious contact with my guide and had no idea who he or she was. How I longed to know. Really, I hadn't any idea how to get in touch. I tried the suggestions in the books, or even just asking, but nothing seemed to work at the time. Obviously, I was doing something wrong. Also, by now, I had come to accept the principles of reincarnation and past lives. It all seemed to make such perfect sense. Then, of course, the most pressing questions for me was, who was I? Where was I? What did I do? I searched and searched and produced nothing. This was incredibly frustrating. After many years of hoping for some happening or deja vu experience, I resigned myself to the fact that I may never know. Also by now, I had come to accept the principles. No, in time, I became ill and required an operation. This done, I developed a Bell's facial palsy, which did not resolve. Although in the nursing profession and confident with modern medicine, I found that no one could help me, and began to seek alternative answers. Through a friend, I went to a local clinic and met Sonia, a naturopathic healer. At that time, she was learning what was considered then a new therapy called the Bowen technique. I was invited to a private session with some of her friends, and they were looking for guinea pigs. Agreeing to participate, this proved to be the turning point for which I had been waiting for so long. After the session, I was drinking a welcome cup of tea. Oh, yeah, good idea. Yeah. When I started to get spontaneous images of a past life, the details... clarity astonished me. No wonder I had always loved trains. I had been a Russian engine driver called Yuri. This event opened the floodgates of my memories. In my dreams, I began to see vivid details of my life as Yuri, and more imagery came to me quite unexpectedly. I knew I should record all of this information, and I started keeping a journal, and each entry dated. Also, I drew sketches of the clear pictures that I was seeing. With friends, I discussed these exciting developments, and they suggested that I should go to a professional therapist and be regressed. However, at that time, it didn't feel right. For 4 years, I meticulously recorded all the details of my inner experiences concerning this Russian past life. I did much research. Then, one night, after a particularly vivid dream, a voice in my head said, "This is the last communication about Yuri. The rest is up to you." It was December 1997. The following February, as a birthday treat, I visited the local crystal therapist for some healing and energy balancing to discover what this form of treatment felt like. We had never met, and she knew very little about me. During the treatment, she suddenly spoke, "Within 4 weeks, you will meet a man who will change your life. I laughed and made the usual light-hearted comments, feeling this was just a little too far-fetched. Soon after this, my close friend Denise came to me and explained that she had decided to go and have a past life regression to deal with some issues that had come up for her. She told me she had found a local therapist and I ought to go too. All at once, I knew that the time was now right. I had put this off long enough. Organizing an appointment with Paul, I quite unwittingly fulfilled the crystal therapist's prediction. It was just 4 weeks later. Albany. Maybe it's Albany. Let's say Albany. After several sessions with Paul, he suggested that I join a healing development class he was running. So, on the due date, I went along. I began to learn much more with his teaching, and was both surprised and delighted that I could actually channel healing energy. This I found immensely satisfying. We also began to learn about our spirit guides. It was about halfway through the 8-week course that Paul invited me to join his healing circle group. This was something I had wanted for so long. Immediately, I felt at home with the various members of the group, and my learning continued apace. A whole new experience was opening up for me. One evening, at the class, a regular member of the group came to speak to us and to demonstrate channeling. Her spirit guide would come through her, speak to us, and answer questions. I had never seen this before and was fascinated. While in trance, our friend's guide began to speak. It was her voice, but obviously not her talking. I sat in amazement, quite unable to ask any questions, although afterwards I could think of lots. I was impressed with the absolute trust that must be required by the channel. To allow a spirit being to take you over and speak through your body seems such a brave thing to do. I felt frightened by the prospect that I would never do that. Soon, though, things started happening. I had been to Penrith one particular day and was driving back down the M6. It is a trip I do regularly, and I know the route well. The motorway was relatively quiet, and I was enjoying the drive through the mountains on a sunny spring day. The scenery was glorious, and I was in a relaxed mood. We had just come over Shap Summit when I heard a really clear voice in my head, so clear it was almost as if someone in the car had spoken. "Leave the motorway at the next exit." I was about halfway from home, and, as it was such a beautiful day, decided to do as instructed, and take the back road through the Lune Gorge to Kendal. I left the M6 at Tebe. A short way along, the road recrosses the motorway. I looked over the bridge and saw, to my astonishment, the southbound carriageway was at a complete standstill. A trailer had broken loose and was lying smashed to pieces right across the road. I thought about this all the way home, thinking about the voice and how incredibly clear it had been. I resolved to ask about this when our group next met. But before our next meeting, another incident occurred which saved my life. Again, I was driving on a regular route. In front of me was a heavy lorry moving slowly, and another car. I knew there was a straight stretch of road ahead where, if safe to do so, I could overtake. When we reached this section, the road was clear. The car in front of me overtook, and I planned to follow. In the split second between the decision and the action of putting my foot on the accelerator, the voice spoke again. "Don't overtake!" My foot froze, and the lorry in front indicated to turn right and moved into the middle of the road. It was going down a farm track, which I would never have expected. I released a pent-up breath and allowed the car to slow. Again, the voice had been sharp, clear, and insistent, and had saved me from a terrible accident. At our next group meeting, I was keen to share my experiences. That evening, when one of the group was channeling her guide for questions, I asked about what happened to me. "The answer surprised you." "The answer surprised me." "That is your guide speaking to you. If you are hearing so clearly, you are obviously in good contact and should be able to channel." The reaction on my face must have looked somewhat comical. Me? A channel? I felt shocked and excited. For, For the rest of the evening, I was suitably quiet and thoughtful. My mind was in a whirl when I went home. Then suddenly I realized, somewhere deep inside, that I did want to channel. Something within me had changed. I felt I was ready to do it now. One night during the following week, I awoke from a deep sleep, sensing someone close by. I couldn't see anyone, but felt a distinct presence. My husband was fast asleep, and all was quiet. Then I heard the voice again, female, gentle but clear. "Hello, my voice is Albany." That was all. Her presence was gone, like someone had left the room. I sat up, staring into the darkness, feeling elated, excited. It was difficult to get back to sleep. Paul offered to teach me to channel. Reassuring me, Paul put me through a relaxation process, then asked me to allow Albany to come close. The feeling that followed was extraordinary and difficult to describe. I could sense her close to my right side, almost touching me. Then I felt a definite sensation as she merged herself with me. It was deliciously warm, tingling, and very pleasant. I felt myself beginning to drift. Next, I became aware of my voice speaking, but it wasn't me. After that, I just seemed to go into a deep state, from which sometime later, Paul brought me back. I had done it, and I was thrilled and delighted. The feeling in my body was physically wonderful. The session had been recorded on tape, and it was the oddest of feelings hearing my voice, speaking so differently, answering questions and talking so knowledgeably about the world of spirit, past lives and personal matters. Thus started my relationship with Albany. Soon, I began to get images of her in my inner vision. I could see her clearly. Her appearance is tall and slender, fair skin, with beautiful deep blue eyes. She has long white blonde hair, which she wears plaited, and usually wears a long turquoise or lemon gown. Sometimes she wears loose trousers. She seems to like a change, just like we do. I cannot now imagine what life would be like without her by my side. Knowing she is there is a great comfort. At times in the past, when I have had to face a really difficult family crisis or other seemingly unresolvable problem, something just made me sit down and cry out, "Please help me." On one occasion, I felt an arm around my shoulders, giving me comfort. I thought at the time it was my imagination, but I know differently now. The sense of her presence is wise and loving. She's my friend, my guide, and my very close companion. There is a bond of love between us that is very deep and beautiful. I know now she was there all the time, waiting for me to take that first step. And the longest of journeys starts with a single step. My interest in Atlantis. When I first started working with Paul, I realized through conversation that we had a mutual interest in the ancient civilizations, the history of the Earth, and in particular, in the legendary lost continent of Atlantis. I had always, as long as I could remember, been fascinated by the stories of lost and ancient civilizations. Lyonnais, Lemuria, Mu, etc. Somehow they sparked something inside of me. The very fact that there was little known about them added to the mystery. Most books on the subject were speculative and skeptical. As little in the way of proof had ever been found. I loved the fantastic element in the tales, the magic. The idea that these people, who lived before recorded history, seemed to possess knowledge and abilities beyond our own, intrigued me. There were many things mysterious in which I was interested. Throughout my life, I had visited ancient sites, stone circles, and the like. I could feel their energy, sense an ancient connection to the earth. The fact that these places, too, were little understood made them much more attractive. Over time, I visited many of these sites in Britain. One year, I made a trip to the Isles of Scilly. a really magical place. I realized as I stood on a rocky headland, I may actually be standing on the ancient land of Lyonesse, of Arthurian legend. Then, as I looked out across to the west, over miles and miles of ocean, my thoughts turned to Atlantis. Somewhere out there, beneath the waves, I felt, lay what remained of that legendary continent. I first learned of Atlantis as a child, in old, musty library books. The place fascinated me. There was nothing much written, just a few lines and old theoretical maps drawn hundreds of years ago, which showed a large landmass roughly mid-Atlantic. I drew pictures of places and people, seeing it as a green and fertile land with great buildings, cities and temples, and a proud people, tall and dark-haired, who ultimately brought about their own destruction. From my inner vision, I could see them, fleeing the sinking lands in small boats, fire and chaos behind them. My friends and parents dismissed the sketches as a product of an overactive imagination, but I knew they were real. I had lived there. Eventually, I decided to explore this part of my past. Paul and I discussed this, and I was taken back. Back to a place that was real and beautiful, with snow-capped mountains, green valleys, large cities of white stone, and the dark-haired people I had seen in my imagination. The one thing I did not expect was some of the darker aspects of life I was about to uncover. In a seemingly idyllic physical setting, the people were corrupt, cruel, and arrogant. It was a society that thrived on corruption, ambition, and greed. Some of the things I discovered took my breath away with horror. To see some of these events was very difficult. To realize I had directly participated was almost impossible to accept. Over time, I have learned that inside of me, I have the memory of many lives on Atlantis. Throughout its 15,000-year history, some, I am happy to say, I've experienced as positive and healing, but many were not. In a substantial number of the experiences described in this book, I was responsible. I was responsible for some terribly dark deeds indeed. For a long time I have struggled to come to terms with some of these events. However, as I have done so, I have felt cleansed and renewed, and have been able to start a process of forgiving myself, deep within, for the terrible things I did, all those thousands of years ago. It has been very difficult for me to begin to see the shortcomings of my own soul's path, but I have begun to see, with a new vision, a way forward now. I sincerely hope that all the bad things are behind me. I'm striving hard to accept this life's trials and tribulations gracefully, knowing that they are a pattern I have both chosen and have had to redress to balance myself. Chapter 8. The Regression Experiences in this book. It was soon obvious to me after I started working with Linda that she had a whole range of past life experiences that she wanted to explore. Some of these extended to times and places that were not very familiar to me from my previous work with clients, but which nevertheless I found very interesting and sometimes compelling in their contents. Linda had a very rich and involved inner life with an active awareness of her soul's history that seemed to stretch back for aeons. My work with her using hypnosis and guided meditations had the effect of opening her awareness much further and deeper. I found that Linda was a person who could quite spontaneously enter into an altered state of consciousness in her everyday life. She may get flashes of past life memory or other psychic impulses coming to her. Within her dreams also, this was another means for her to gain further access to her inner life. Of course, all this increased through her work with me, but I was struck by the authenticity of her experience. When she shared with me, I felt she was telling me the truth as she knew it. She trusted me, and it was very important for her, for me to accept her experiences. I could do that, even though some of her experiences challenged my own concepts and belief systems. Linda was facing some quite severe problems in her life, and I wanted to help her with this. But as I began to delve with her into her past life memories, what seemed most helpful with these experiences could be like a gateway to her spiritual self. With her emotional sensitivity, the regressions could give her deep self-understanding and relief. It was not long before we started to access Atlantean past lives. At first it appeared that there were indications of only two or three lives from Atlantis that may be relevant. But the number just kept on growing, and the involvement needed and complexity of these lives grew too. After a while, regressions to other places seemed to lose their significance, and tracing the threads of Linda's Atlantean experiences became predominant in our work. The seed thought of writing a book about Atlantis gradually developed, especially once Denise and Lynn also embarked on their own Atlantean past life inner journeys. Linda's guide, Albany, was instrumental in encouraging this idea, but Linda recognized that for her, the most important aspect of the work was the help that it was giving her to her own inner development. As time went on, there were many of Linda's Atlantean experiences where she felt she recognized me as one of the other characters in the experience. Sometimes I could even sense this before she spoke it. At other times it was less immediately clear to me. But this helped to awaken in me a curiosity and interest to know what had been my own experience of these lives and others in Atlantis. I wondered how I could do it. Then gradually came the idea, which seemed like a unique experiment, to help me access my own past lives from Atlantis. I had been very impressed with Albany's guidance and help with Linda around her experience. Albany had much knowledge relating to Atlantis, and she also displayed much therapeutic sensitivity regarding Linda's inner needs at times when I could not help. So I thought that I would ask Albany if she could be my therapist and help me access my Atlantean past lives. I did not feel that I could ask Linda because she had no training as a therapist, but her spiritual guide, Albany, appeared to be quite competent. When I spoke to Albany about this, she seemed to be quite excited by the prospect. But she also explained to me that she had not done anything like this before. Finally, we conducted our first experiment doing this. I guided Linda into a trance so she could channel Albany. Then Albany guided me into regression. I felt very safe with Albany's guidance. I had been feeling quite nervous and insecure about how well I would be able to accomplish my aims. But Albany's voice was firm and sure. She led me with an induction that I had never used with clients before. However, it was simple and effective, and I found myself entering into an experience of Atlantean past life, experiencing much more fully with more detail than I had expected. Following on from the regression, when it had ended, I could talk with Albany about my thoughts, feelings and doubts, and she was able to reassure me and help me process the experience. Altogether, it was a very satisfying and successful experiment, and formed the beginning of many further regression experiences which I have had. When I had come out of my regression and finished talking with Albany, I could then bring Linda out of the trance and the session would be over. I have been very grateful for Linda's help with this. We taped the session so a record of it would remain for afterwards. As we have built up our bank of Atlantean past life experiences, we have found that we could only include a small selection of these for the purposes of this book. This is really only because we did not want the book to be too voluminous, for many of the experiences we have not included are very interesting, and we will devote a brief chapter later into the book to mentioning some of these. We have tried to choose lives which would help present some of the main contours of the history of Atlantis, some of the main aspects of its culture, the way people lived and mistakes which people could make. Then we also wanted to give some insights about the personal soul journeys which Linda and I have each made throughout Atlantean sojourns and lifetimes that were very significant in this. So then, there could be an inner and outer component to the regression experiences, which we hope would be interesting to the reader. The regression experiences have been arranged for the purposes of this book in historical order, from the Foundation times first, through to experiences connected to the final destruction of Atlantis at the end. This does not reflect how these lives unfolded in our therapy sessions, for the progress from one regression lifetime to another rarely follows an historical pattern, but tends much more to unfold through a kind of resonance linking similar experiences. But in the way we have set out the experiences, we hope that this will be simple and coherent to read. We realize that the history of Atlantis is a vast subject, but we hope that the thoughts of this book and the regression experiences will add to that knowledge. We have not attempted to study what others have written on the subject, but to rely solely upon the experiences that have come to us. With that, we have tried to be truthful and honest to what our inner experiences and intuition have told us to be so. Chapter 9, Channeling Albany's Commentaries. Throughout the writing of this book, I have had many engrossing conversations with Albany, Linda's spiritual guide. To do this, it has been a simple matter to guide Linda into a trance state and to ask for Albany to come forward and speak. She does this very easily. Sometimes Albany has begun to channel spontaneously, with Linda drifting into trance of her own accord. Linda's consciousness would willingly move aside to let Albany speak, and then Linda would have no memory of the conversation afterwards. Usually, we would tape these sessions so Linda would have the opportunity to study what Albany said. The amount of detailed knowledge concerning various aspects of Atlantean life that Albany had been able to share had been impressive. However, as with all channeled teachings, I have found it very important to challenge within myself what has been said and really use my own intuition to test what feels true from the information that has been given. I have noticed that Albany has tended to be selective about what she has told us. For instance, if one of us were about to undergo a regression to a particular period in Atlantean history, we would be told very little about this in advance. Then the experience of the regression would come purely through our own minds and not be coloured by Albany's thoughts or by expectations we had set up within ourselves by what she had said to us. For me, it has been essential that we proceed in this way. I have not wanted to know what might happen in one of my regressions beforehand. Otherwise, it could be argued that the regressions in this book are projections from Albany's thoughts rather than genuine individual experiences. And I know that this is not true. Throughout the rest of the book, there are a number of commentaries by Albany about various phases of the history of Atlantis. These sections have taken a question and answer form and are largely unedited transcripts from channeled sessions that have been recorded on tape. As I have implied, these commentaries were compiled after the relevant regression experiences related to these periods has been accessed. We're going to start with Albany's commentary about the beginnings of Atlantis. From there, we will move on to regression experiences related to the first settlements on Atlantis, and then go further. Part 2, The Regressions and Commentaries. Chapter 10, The Foundations of Atlantis. Commentary by Albany. Paul, how did the continent of Atlantis form physically, and how did people first start coming there? Albany, the formation of the continent was as with all other land, and came through earth movement and a general change in the structure of the earth's surface. This is an ongoing process, but in the earlier times the earth was more unstable and change occurred at a much faster rate than it does now. As you know, down what is now the central Atlantic, it is a major fault and a major movement point on the earth's surface. This is how the continent came into being. It came from this area. Land mass was formed, as it always is, by a thrusting upwards of the general surface from beneath the water. This occurred in modern times quite quickly, but it took a long, long time in reality. At the same time, other earth movements were occurring. It is a reciprocal thing. If one thing moves, then something else has to move to allow for it. There has to be a give and take within the surface. It is like if you imagine ice flows moving. One moves and then another moves and they release the pressure together on themselves. This is a reasonable picture to us because, as you know, beneath the crust of the earth is a molten material. It is upon this that the actual crust and surfaces move, albeit slowly by your standards. This is roughly what happened. Along the central land there was most activity. As the land-forming material came through in the form of volcanic activity, the actual surface of the land flowed outwards from this central point to the east and to the west and formed a longitudinal continent which is eventually settled as the earth movement settled. Along the central spine of the land where there was most activity were the high mountains. Well, these were pushed up in the last activity which settled down when the continent settled down. Towards east and west were lower mountains, lower hills and flat plains leading to the sea. When this eventually settled down, a lot of the land was barren. But immediately on the land cooling and becoming ready for life, then life appeared. It happened in many ways. At that stage the land was very fertile, much more fertile than you could possibly imagine, I feel. Anything that landed, seeds or anything like that, would grow very quickly. What also happened, which is not unique to Atlantis, but something for which is well known for, is the crystal formation. As you know, these minerals are formed under great pressure, and that is exactly what happened when the mountains were forming. The formation of these huge crystal beds tended to be roughly down the center of the continent, where the highest mountains were situated. They were numerous and very, very large. These exerted a tremendous energy. It is this energy which the crystals exerted that drew life and eventually drew people to the continent. For this energy went out into the general energy field of the earth and was a tremendously powerful influence. There are other lines of crystals in longitudinal sections down the earth still. They are very much an essential part of the earth's magnetic field. But most people do not know of their existence. They tend to be in mountain chains and places of very ancient volcanic activity. Paul, can you say something about the size and shape of Atlantis? It was essentially on a longitudinal axis, north to south, much longer than its lateral axis, east to west. The equatorial belt roughly came across two-thirds of the way down. The bulk of the continent was in the northern hemisphere, again bearing in mind that there are slightly more different measurements now, that is roughly where it was. The overall size covered a vast area. Its northern point, now I need to transpose the old geography onto the new modern geography, the northernmost point was approximately in a latitude level with what is now, I think, Portugal. The southernmost tape would go down to about the Tropic of Capricorn. It was much, much bigger than what you call modern Europe. One of the easiest ways to describe it is if you imagine the mass of land of what you call North America turned on its side and moved across to the Atlantic, then that would be slightly larger than the Atlantean continent. In other words, if you took the American continent from Newfoundland down to California, turned it diagonally and moved it across to the place I've described, leaving out all the various protrusions which are around, and try to imagine it almost as an ovoid, I think that's about right. It is not an easy thing to describe, as you can appreciate. The climatic conditions varied from the north to the south. The north was more temperate, the south more tropical. But the earth was warmer then, so you'd have to allow for that. It was also more rich with vegetation. For as you're probably aware, the area that is now the Sahara Desert was lush vegetation and forest. The change in that air, that was again caused by people's neglect, which is entirely another story. But the continent of Atlantis had a very equable climate, and it was a very pleasant place to be. A lot of people would think it was like the Greek Elysian fields or the various idyllic places that have been described over the years by your poets and artists. The mountain chains were high and were snow-capped, even on the equator, as is Mount Kilimanjaro. The range of vegetation reflected the climatic differences. What was there were plants and biological diversity, which in many ways does not exist now. Certain things were unique to that land and were lost when the land submerged. Certain things were brought with the people escaping the land. For some of the more enlightened people leaving realized that there were very precious things. They took with them seeds and plants and various things like that to take to their new place. But these have changed biologically and evolved. So there are many things in that form which existed on the Atlantean continent that are no longer with us. This is not a particularly bad thing, as you may think, for nature has changed, the biology has changed, and has simply been an ongoing process of change. But there were plants that we used then, that are around now, and in a very southern area, it tended to be more lush and perhaps what you may describe as rainforest, but it wasn't quite like that. It wasn't quite as dense as the rainforest you know now. The animal life was much the same. There were mammals, small mammals, with a tremendous variety of birds. Atlantis was rich with bird life. Again, some were unique and some were lost with the continent. Birds could fly away, be transported by people, and this did happen. Up in the mountains you had snowfields, the land above the tree line, where different plants grew and where different biological patterns existed. Of course, people with their skills would inhabit all of these places. But the essence of Atlantis was its energy. It was tremendously energetic because the amount of crystals which were there within the land. Paul. How did the animal and human life come to Atlantis, and from where did it come? Originally there were very temporary land bridges, and they were due to the instability of what was then the ocean floor. The main land bridge was from the Iberian Peninsula. A lot of animal life crossed from there. There were also very brief connections with what is now known as the African continent. These were very tenuous links and were soon broken by the movement of the Earth's crust. But in the very short time they existed, animal life moved across them and from what evolved into their own unique patterns on the continent of Atlantis. When people arrived, they brought with them domestic animals, and this added to the physical diversity of the fauna on the land. Birds flew there, but some birds were brought by people because, as you know, some of them cannot fly that far. Insect life and plant life travels in a different way, very often together. Insect life came with the animals in a parasitic form or simply by being carried as eggs or various forms of pupa or things like that. Quite inadvertently, things even actually float upon the sea and survive a long sea journey and land on beaches on land and become alive again. Some things can stay in a form of dormancy until the conditions are right. So you have various and many different ways of populating a new land. All that time ago, the people, the population of the earth, and the general energies of the earth were much, much stronger. The people were more psychically aware. They were more aware of these energies and what they meant. As you have probably realized, the migration of animals is purely to do with them sensing the lines of energy and knowing which way to go by this roadmap that is in their heads. They work with these lines of energy. They follow this within themselves quite automatically. People at this time also had a great deal of this ability. Some people still have. It is part of the psychological makeup of the human form that you should always be able to tune into lines of energy. But most people nowadays have lost its ability, as with their psychic sense. But then, some of the people on other continents, sensitive people, for there are always some people more sensitive than others, sensed this new land. They knew that out there, across this ocean, was something strong and wonderful. It was drawing them. The crystal energy was drawing them into the grid. They sensed along their own grid lines. They sensed that out there was something very important and a new land. They could feel its energy. They could feel its magnetic attraction. For this is what the Earth wanted. It wanted the human population to spread. It had created this beautiful new land, and essentially, it was there for people to use. For the Earth looks after her children. She made this beautiful place for them. As one place was becoming less energetic and losing its power, then another was created to replace it. It is an ongoing process. As Lemuria was failing and becoming worn out, As Lemuria was failing and becoming worn out and tired, then Atlantis was created, as well as other land movements. So you're suggesting that there were more dramatic land movements then than what most scientists in our present age would acknowledge? Yes, indeed. That is because the Earth in its younger years was more dynamic. But we're looking at only 25,000 years ago. Yes, they were the last major changes. The last major change was probably the sinking of Atlantis, for that was when the depths of the Atlantic Ocean was formed. And I think things settled down more after that. But there were periods of what you call great instability and a lot of movement, and periods of great settlement when things did not happen. This is again a cyclical thing over a long period of time. But yes, the movements were much more dramatic, which I think, fortunately for the Earth's population today, seems to have settled down. There are movements today, but they are purely adjustments of pressure in many ways, and very often associated with the activities of people. Most scientists would tend to view early settlements of human beings, especially around the time of about 25,000 BC, as being primitive, more hunter-gatherer societies. You seem to have a different view of that. Albany. Yes, for you are looking at a different history. You are looking at something which people have not yet perceived. Although now more is coming forward that there were civilizations at that time which were more advanced than has been previously imagined. It is simply that they have not had the proof of this. And, as you know, scientists must always have proof. It will come. It is coming now. They have the proof there, but they do not understand what it is. There is much speculation in some eras as to what is being found. Eventually, they will realize. But at the moment, it is challenging their scientific thought. Having said that, you have to accept. You have to accept reality. You have to accept initially that Atlantis existed. You have to also accept that Lemuria, Mu, and the Siberian civilizations also existed. That is the first step. So, if they existed, then therefore the civilizations must have been more socially advanced than is thought. They were not purely hunter-gatherers as would be assumed. Yes, primitive society did exist in certain places, but there was also a great deal of civilization too. And you simply have to accept this, for these continents were there. These people did exist. It is still within the memory of many, many people who are in existence today. This is why there is a much broader acceptance today, certainly of Atlantis. But Atlantis is the last in a long line of lost continents. Therefore, perhaps the rational mind can accept Atlantis a little better, for it is, shall we say, more recent. But going back beyond that pushes the modern mind a little into thinking that perhaps this is all fantasy. However, this is not so. Paul, from which places did the people come mainly to settle Atlantis? Mainly they came from places immediately bordering it. The biggest source of migration came from Lemuria, which was at the top end of what is now South America, from the southwest towards Atlantis. Paul, as I understand it, Lemuria was going through a lot of instability at that time, and most of the people were leaving. Yes. For, as the events leading to the formation of Atlantis settled down, and the continent settled into being, then on the other side, or further across the Earth's plates, the opposite was happening. Again, it is a reaction of one Earth movement to another. Lemuria as a continent was becoming more unstable. The continent of Lemuria had been existing a long time. Again, it had a central fault line. That was on the fault line that is now on the western side of South America, and runs right up the American plate. This line went down roughly the centre of Lemuria. As you can probably imagine, as the other fault line moved, then so did that one, and caused a great deal of change. Eventually, part of Lemuria, the western part, went into what is now the Pacific Ocean. There are simply small remains, as in the small islands that are a long way off the west coast of South America. The main one, which most people find interesting, is Easter Island. So Easter Island was once part of Lemuria. It was, but only a tiny, tiny part. What were the other main places from where the population came? There was what is now known as the European area, which is to the northeast. People came from that direction. They did not essentially use the land bridges. That was mainly for animals. People could sail across, use the boats, and they could approach by sea. Also, there were crossings from what is now the African land, so they were the main points. Strangely, the area that is now North America was not well populated at the time. The main bulk of immigrants came from Lemuria to the southwest of Atlantis. However, there was a considerable settlement in the northeast also. It was like an opposite at either end, and smaller groups came across from the African area, for the African continent was less populated too. Were each of these civilizations quite advanced? What was the cultural influence of each of these groupings? The most advanced were the people who came from Lemuria, for they came from the most ancient of the lands. The ones from the northeast were not quite so far advanced culturally, but they all came from a tradition that honored the earth energy. For this was quite natural at that time. As I have said, the whole of the earth's population was much more sensitive and much more aware of this. Therefore, no matter what part they came from, the people were very much aware of the honoring of the earth energy. So the cultures that had grown up were somewhat similar, for they are all based on roughly the same principles. They approach from a slightly different manner, but the essence of their belief and culture were much the same. Climatic variations made a difference with these people, but essentially they were coming from almost the same direction belief-wise. They felt part of the land, felt a kinship with the Earth Mother, for the sensitivity was strong. The people from Lemuria came from a very ancient tradition, for they were originally populated from Mu. Therefore, the tradition was carried forward. The ones from the African continent were also reasonably well advanced. The ones with the least cultural advancement were the ones from the northeast, from the colder climates of the north. Were there any primitive type people settling Atlantis? No, for essentially they did not move much, for it was the more advanced who were more aware of what was happening, for these people had priests or psychic leaders within their societies. In order to have that, they needed to have a reasonable advancement within the social structure. The primitive peoples, although very aware of the earth energies, were quite stationary. Some were nomadic, but they tended to stay within their own climactic area. They did not feel the need to move, and felt very attracted to their own land. The more advanced civilizations had the ability to build ships. They had the knowledge, need, and urge to move on, the need for advancement. This comes with advancement in the intellect sense. What kind of language? What about language? What kind of language was brought to Atlantis? This was as varied as the people. It is hard to describe in modern terms, but eventually, as in many continents which have come from a diversity of languages, a common tongue developed. The need to communicate was strong. Within that, as with the modern situation, there was a common tongue, but also regional variations. I'm not necessarily speaking of dialects, but of language. Atlantis was a very large continent, and it took some time for various groups of people to actually come across each other. When they did, they managed to communicate, and over time they developed into a common tongue. The language in modern terms is extremely difficult to describe. I think the nearest that modern people would have any conception of, or is a very different form of tongue, would be the ancient Mayan language. That is as near to Atlantean as you're likely to get. So when we come up with the names of characters from these different past lives, then the sound of the names we sense is perhaps a near approximation to what these people may have been called then. Most definitely, it is a phonetic approximation, and if the names appear modern, as in modern English, this is purely and simply the only way you can express it. The language itself would be very difficult to say some... the language itself would be very difficult for, say, someone who speaks English to intonate. It was a very guttural and throaty language with a lot of sibilant sounds. You would use the letter X from your alphabet a lot. To learn the Atlantean language now, you would need to learn it phonetically, and you would also have to learn a very different system of writing and written work, which they had, as all of the ancient civilizations did. How did they write? It depended a lot initially of where the area was, for they used what was around at the time. In the southern part, where the weather was warmer, they used a form. The nearest you have to it would be the Egyptian papyrus. But it was made from plant substances. It was essentially, I suppose, a thick form of paper, and was not too dissimilar to modern paper. The method of making the marks come from forms of paint and ink. Ink and paint have existed for as long as people have inhabited the planet. It has always been realized that these could be used to make a mark upon something. Pigments of the earth have always been used by people for self-expression. 4. How did people in those times express their sexuality? The answer to that is very liberally. There were no real rules that would put on the population. They did not feel that there were any barriers. They were open-minded. In most of the population areas, this was not considered a problem. There was little in the way of barriers between the sexes, and initially there was a great deal of equality. People who you now refer to as gay or homosexual were accepted quite normally. There were no inhibitions. There were no inhibitions. It was a very sexually free society. But this could lead to a great deal of problems, as some of the regressions have shown you.
You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.